The word of the Lord shall come from the gospel according to Matthew, chapter 26, verses 17 through 30. Now on the first day of unleavened bread, the disciples came to Jesus saying, "Where will you have us prepare for you to eat the Passover?" He said, "Go into the city to a certain man and say to him, 'The teacher says, my time is at hand. I will keep the Passover at your house with my disciples.' And the disciples did as Jesus had directed them, and they prepared the Passover. When it was evening, he reclined at table with the 12. And as they were eating, he said, 'Truly, I say to you, one of you will betray me.' And they were very sorrowful and began to say to him one after another, 'Is it I, Lord?' He answered, 'He who has dipped his hand in the dish with me will betray me. The Son of Man goes as it is written of him. But woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been better for that man if he had not been born.' Judas, who would betray him, answered, 'Is it I, Rabbi?' He said to him, 'You have said so.' Now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, and after blessing it, broke it and gave it to the disciples and said, 'Take, eat, this is my body.' And he took a cup, and when he had given thanks, he gave it to them, saying, 'Drink of it, all of you, for this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I tell you, I will not drink again of this fruit of the vine until the day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom.' And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives." The word of the Lord.
Good morning, Beeson Divinity. It is such an honor to be with you all this morning. Doug Sweeney, thank you for the invitation. Anna Russell, wherever you are organizing the world, thank you for organizing mine. Outstanding faculty of Samford University. Yeah, it's good to be here. And y'all, you rock. All right. As we have read for this morning, our passage is Matthew 26, what many would call the communion passage, yeah? A passage that is familiar, so familiar that some might even characterize it as a bit overdone, yeah? Perhaps dull. Oh my goodness, can I say that? The kind of passage that once you recognize it, you might just stop listening, sort of tune out. No show of hands here this morning, just kind of saying it out loud. Because, well, we already know what it's going to say, right? But in this last week of Lent, when we are doing our final gear up for the High Holidays, right? The inundation of all of the celebrations that have not only changed the course of world history, but are the events that have made us Christians. Well, can I say that this passage is anything but mundane? So, we're going to pick up this story during Jesus' last week on earth. Having spent the bulk of his ministry up in the Galilee at a safe distance from the Jewish seat of power in Jerusalem, Jesus heads south. Now he knows that in coming to Jerusalem, he is making himself vulnerable to seizure and to arrest. He knows that his enemies have already identified him as a problem that needs to be dealt with, but he also knows that it's time. It's the Spring High Holidays in Jerusalem, yeah? The week before the great Passover celebration, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of the First Fruits. So you can be assured that this city is absolutely packed out. Every available space is in use. We've got Uncle Shlomo and Aunt Rachel in the guest room, yeah? Cousin Yosef and his four kids are camped out in the backyard. Grandma and Grandpa have rolled in their RV in the driveway. The motels, hotels, even the YMCA, absolutely overflowing. And there are merchants everywhere. Folks are running around to gather the supplies for the great feasts. Chaos. And adding to this chaos, in case you have never pondered it, according to Josephus, there are more, I'm realizing I'm not using that, it's out of the way. Josephus informs us that on any given year during Herod's temple, there are 250,000 lambs gathered in the capital city. Yeah, are we talking chaos, noise, people? You need to be thinking of the shuk in Jerusalem, or perhaps Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July, or maybe Daytona Beach during spring break, Disney World during second kid comes free coupon day, or the Quidditch World Cup. Come on, you're with me. So packed out that if you turn down the wrong street, well, forget about it. That's where you're going. So packed out that you can smell the guy next to you, and it's not a happy thing. It is into this chaos of celebration, joy, and relatives you forgot you had that Jesus comes riding in on that donkey. The crowds go wild. People are so overwhelmed at his entry into Jerusalem that they are throwing their clothes in the street. Now, I have been very excited before. I have been in Washington, D.C. on the 4th of July. I have been to a Justin Bieber concert. But I have never thrown my clothes in the middle of the street. Yeah, and can you imagine his homeboys? Think about it for just a moment. They are rednecks from Nazareth, yeah? And they are with a rock star. Yeah, this is the moment. We are riding the wave. Guys, this is a revolution, and this guy is the Mockingjay. Yeah, so exciting, so overwhelming. Folks, Jesus is going to spend this week ministering to those very same crowds. Everywhere he goes, complete fangirl frenzy. He can heal the lame, give sight to the blind. His preaching is mesmerizing, and perhaps best, he can take out a Sadducee or a Pharisee at will, and he has no qualms about stepping into the arena. Again, can you imagine being in that crowd? I suspect that the regular folk who are watching Jesus do his thing felt like that moment when you're on social media, having an absurd argument with an equally absurd opponent, yeah? And they're claiming that the world is flat or that COVID-19 was Russian espionage, you know? And you're trying to give back actual data and you're getting nowhere, and then all of a sudden, a friend on your friend list that you forgot you ever had comes zooming in. They have a PhD from Vanderbilt. They have a degree from MIT. They're working for NASA, and they totally put that guy in his place. You know that feeling? I think that is what the crowd is experiencing as Jesus is calling out the Pharisees for straining at a gnat but swallowing a camel, when he totally kicks them over for devouring widows' houses, when he breathes life back into their traditions and their faith. Jesus is drawing a crowd, yeah? He's got his 10,000 followers, and oh, is he irritating his opponents. His insight, his encyclopedic knowledge of the scriptures, his pointed criticisms. Guys, the temperature in this city is rising. Yeah, he knows that the religious leaders have already decided that he is a problem that he must be dealt with. He knows that Judas intends to betray him. He knows that his time is limited. So we pick up Matthew 26, now on the first day of the Festival of Unleavened Bread. The disciples came to Jesus. Where do you want us to prepare for you to eat the Passover? And he says, go into the city to a certain man and say to him, the teacher says, my time is at hand. I'm to keep the Passover at your house with my disciples. And the disciples did as Jesus directed them, and they prepared the Passover. We could spend a week right there. But the first thing that you and I need to remember about our high holidays is that they were given to us during the Passover. And the first thing that we need to remember about our communion meal that is birthed of these words is that it was given to us during the Passover meal. All right, so let's talk about the Passover meal for a moment. One of the highest holy days in the Jewish liturgical calendar, because it marked the impossible escape from Egypt. It marked the incomparable day of the Exodus. It is the Christmas Eve of Judaism, that sacred, magical night when the patriarch of every clan gathered his children and his children's children around the table, and he recited to them over a ritual meal the great story. Yeah? This story was recounted to each and every Jew in and out of Jerusalem each and every year. And the question that was on everyone's mind, that is spoken at every juncture, by every symbol in every heart, is, do you remember? Do you remember? Do you remember the greatest single act of redemption that has occurred in human history? That terrifying night when the blood of a spotless lamb was painted on the houses of those who dared to believe. The blood that marked those who would not die. The blood that deflected the wrath of the death angel, that kept the destroyer at bay, the blood that preserved the firstborn of Israel while the firstborn of Egypt died. Do you remember this sacrifice that served as the gateway out of Egypt, out of bondage, into a covenant relationship with Yahweh, your God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Do you remember? This is the point of the Passover, and every Jew was required to set aside that holy evening to remember Yahweh, their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. And according to the Mishnah, every Jew was commanded to regard himself as though he himself walked out of Egypt that day. Passover was the night in which the God who had rescued a nation of slaves was honored. A forgotten people, a gaggle of dirty, poor, illiterate Semites whose only value was the labor that their bodies could produce before someone laid it in the ground. A people who were not a people who had not received mercy, but because of the love and the strength and the will of God became a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession. You recognize passage. Guys, the essence of the Passover celebration was to remember and give thanks for that moment in history when a strong enemy was defeated and tens and thousands of souls were called out of darkness into his marvelous light. That's the Passover, and this is the night in which Jesus chooses to institute our communion meal and our high holiday. What most of us Gentiles don't realize, though, is that there's a very specific structure to the Passover meal. That's where the word Seder actually comes from. It means liturgy or order. And by the time of Jesus' day, that liturgy was broken up by four cups of wine. My kind of holiday. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I said that right here at Beeson Divinity. Okay. So the evening begins with the Kiddush, yeah, a prayer that sets the night apart as holy. The door is closed, the shades are drawn. The patriarch draws the family around the table and he blesses the sacred evening. Each family member drinks the first cup of wine. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu, melech ha'olam. Then the appetizers are eaten, the bitter herbs dipped in salt and some sort of apple, walnut, cinnamon kind of thing. To commemorate the bitterness and oppression of Egypt, the salt of their tears, and how that bitterness was transformed. This is where the narration of the story, the great story, begins. What the Jews know as the Haggadah, the telling. Literally, this moment is when the family rehearses who they are. And I love this. It's the youngest person at the table who asks four questions so that that story can get rehearsed. Father, why is only unleavened bread eaten on this night? Father, why the bitter herbs? Father, why is only roasted meat eaten? And Father, why are there two dippings, the vegetables in salt and the bitter herbs in the haroseth? Why? And the patriarch responds, telling again the great story of God's redemption, instructing his family in the character of their God, a God who is willing to fight for them. And in that process, he tells his family not only who God is, but who they are. And here the second cup of wine is drunk to mark the conclusion of the Haggadah. And then they eat, yeah? And just like my Thanksgiving table, that table is loaded with traditional foods. Unleavened bread, it's kind of like crescent rolls. The lamb, hey, my husband is Greek, you haven't lived until you've eaten roasted lamb in the backyard, with weird Greek music playing, and yeah, it's just like the movie. Okay, maybe a little potato kugel, a bit of green bean casserole for good measure, with joy and laughter and stories. This family celebrates, yeah? And when every stomach is full and when the crescent rolls are all gone, then the third cup of wine to mark the prayer of grace that's following the meal. And this cup is called the cup of redemption. And the verse that is recited is, I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. Finally, we sing the great Hallel, that's Psalms 115 to 118. The fourth cup is drunk, the ceremony is concluded, and everyone stumbles off to the living room to watch NFL while their meal digests, right? You get my point. So let's turn back to the gospel. And while they were eating, Jesus took some bread. I guess all the crescent rolls weren't gone. And after a blessing, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples. And he said, take, eat. This is my body. And when he had taken the cup and given thanks, he gave it to them. Drink from this, all of you. For this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Did you stop listening? Did you hear the words? You need to think of the disciples for just a moment. They are tired, yeah? They've been up since sunrise. And guys, it takes a lot of energy to cast out demons, heal the blind, and have an argument with a Pharisee. On top of that, they've got full bellies. All of that lamb and potato kugel, yeah? And contrary to Leonardo da Vinci, they were likely reclining on the ground, not seated at a table, which only encourages the post-meal nap. You know it. Yeah. And these guys have been listening to the Seder liturgy since they were knee-high to grasshoppers. Are they actually listening to the words? Yeah? Maybe not. That is until Jesus says the wrong words. Yeah? The wrong words. So here we are having eaten the holiday meal and rehearsed the Haggadah. Jesus, who's acting as the patriarch of this little band, takes the third cup of wine, the cup of redemption, and rather than reciting the blessing that everyone in the room has known since birth, he says, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. I can just see James throwing an elbow into John, saying, dude, he just messed up the Seder. I said the wrong words. And then John leans back and says, is he suggesting that we drink his blood? What the heck is going on here? But then they heard it. And not one man in that room would have missed the illusion, so we better not miss it either. You see, we're in Exodus chapter 24. Moses has just received the law. The Israelites are waiting on pins and needles at the foot of Mount Sinai. And we read, then Moses came down and he recounted to these people all of the words of the Lord and all the ordinances. And all the people answered. And they said with one voice, all the words that Yahweh has spoken, we will do. And Moses wrote down all the words of the Lord. And then he arose early in the morning and he built an altar at the foot of the mountain with 12 pillars for the 12 tribes of Israel. And he sent young men out to retrieve burnt offerings, young bulls, and peace offerings to Yahweh. And then Moses took half the blood and he put it in basins, and the other half of the blood he sprinkled on the altar. And then he took the book of the covenant and he read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that Yahweh has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. Listen up. So Moses took the blood and he sprinkled it on the people, and he said, this is the blood of the covenant which Yahweh has made with you in accordance with all these words. Folks, we know what happened at the foot of Mount Sinai. We know that this is the moment when the covenant of Yahweh is ratified with his people. We know that the ratification occurred by the recitation of stipulations, the sacrifice of animals, and the sprinkling of blood on God's people. We know that. Hear the words. This is the blood of the covenant that Yahweh has made with you in accordance with all these words. That's Moses. Jesus, this is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins. Folks, do you hear it? Jesus is using this sacred celebration of Yahweh's deliverance of Israel from Egypt, and he is reassociating it with his own pending deliverance of his people from the bondage of sin and death. Has this become old news to us? He is announcing to his men that something on the level of the Exodus is about to happen here. He is declaring a new covenant and a new people of God. He takes Moses' words and he reinterprets the Passover of the Israelites and transforms it into our communion meal. And just as Moses sealed the Israelites to Yahweh at the foot of Mount Sinai, Jesus is sealing his people to himself on the eve of the crucifixion. Jesus takes what, according to the Passover liturgy, is the third cup of wine, the cup of redemption, and renames that third cup the blood of a new ratification ceremony. But this time the oaths are not sworn or sealed with the blood of rams or bulls. This time the oaths are sealed with the blood of God the Son. Has this become old news to us? Jesus names himself the sacrificial victim slain to provide the blood of the covenant. Do we see it? So the Last Supper of the Passion Week is in reality the declaration of not only a new Passover, but the ratification of a new covenant. Now, in borrowing Moses' words, Jesus is borrowing a ritual that is far older than his humanity. As I'm sure all of your Old Testament professors have taught you here at Beeson Divinity, this is reflective of a second millennia Hittite treaty. Come on. What we are witnessing here is the reenactment of that ratification ceremony. When the lesser king would walk among the slaughtered pieces of the animals sacrificed, recite his oaths, and remind himself of the consequences of breaking covenant. That's what's happening here. And then this ratification ceremony would be followed by a fellowship meal to celebrate the new alliance a fellowship meal in which the animals sacrificed to guarantee the covenant, guarantee this new alliance, were cooked and eaten. Does that sound familiar? A body broken, an oath sworn, a covenant ratified in blood. As we approach our high holidays, know that a story greater than the Exodus is about to unfold. Because this time the enemy who holds us bound is not simply Egypt. It is death and hell itself. And the one who's come to save us has declared himself, his life, the price the ransom paid. He is suzerain, he is vassal, he is sacrificial victim. He is covenant breaker, Adam. He is covenant maker, Yahweh. And we who were once not a people, by the mercy and sacrifice and relentless love of our God, have become a people. Do we remember? Do we know who we are? Now, we never got to the fourth cup, did we? It's time to go there. In verses 29 through 30, Jesus says, I tell you, I will not drink again of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. And when they had sung a song, actually sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Essentially, what Jesus is doing here is he's taking the last cup of the meal, he's placing it in the middle of the table, and he's saying, I'll drink this when I get back. I wonder what they were thinking. I wonder if they were thinking, when I get back from the garden. I'll drink this when I get back. I'll drink this when we're all together again. Once again, totally messing with the liturgy. This cup is called the cup of consummation. It's the end of the meal. Salute when everybody heads into the living room for football, yeah? But instead, what Jesus says is we're not done here. You see, Jesus' unfinished meal, that last cup, is a promise. A promise that his disciples did not yet know they needed. Have you ever been there? Because unlike his disciples, Jesus knows what's about to happen. He knows that the soldiers are already on their way. He knows that the blood money has already been exchanged. He knows that this evening will not end with shouts of laughter and celebration, but rather this evening will end with swords and torches and screaming. He knows his men will scatter. He knows that this world, in all of its fallenness, is about to deliver a blow to their faith that they might not survive. So he's offering them that promise they do not yet know they need. And he's putting it in the middle of the table. And the promise is, brothers and sisters of mine, that we will be together again. We will be together again. That the very gates of hell will not be able to keep Jesus from his people. I'm going to say that again. That the very gates of hell will not be able to keep Jesus from his people. Another table awaits us. And this time there will be no tears, no soldiers, no panic, no death. His oath is that the fellowship that we have right here, right now, is a bond that he has given his very life to make eternal. This fourth cup is a cup of hope. Okay, let me tell you a story and we'll be done. You have been introduced to my two perfect daughters. They are in college now. But once upon a time, they had a cat. And the cat's name was Pichula, which in Greek means little one. And she was the runt of the litter, so little one was appropriate. All right, Pichula was very cute and very manipulative. And she had figured out that she could get pretty much anything she wanted just by being cute. As a result, she was happily overweight, always in someone's lap, and always managed to sleep under the covers. I'm not sure how she pulled that off. And we loved our Pichula. But one day, something went wrong. And the vet thought maybe she got into some antifreeze or she'd hunted something that was poisoned. But her kidneys were shutting down, and the only choice left was to put her down. It was a horrible day. I kept vigil at the vet while Steve was home with the girls, and I brought our sweet patchouli home in a box. My husband, who would have sworn that he hated that cat, tears streaming down his face, he was red-faced, and he'd already dug the grave, yeah? My girls, they were little, and they were distraught. My youngest one, I love this. She knelt down by the box, you know, in that complete squat that only a toddler body can do, yeah? And she said, "Pichula, you get out of that box. Pichula, you get out of that box." Because my little one didn't understand death. My bigger one, 5, 6 years old, was inconsolable. We had our kitty funeral, we were very sad, and to my emerging parent surprise, day long, my big girl asked me, Mommy, tell me again, what will happen to Pichula? And so I launched into the story, and I said, "Honey, Pichula has died. She's gone to be with Jesus. Now, hold on." I do have a master's in theology from Gordon Conwell. It is true that my PhD is in that silly Hebrew Bible thing. But I do know that we are not yet assured of what will happen to our sweet little pets on the other side, and I am not truly expecting to see Pichula's resurrected little body in the heavenlies. But it was a teachable moment, so, you know, give me some space here. Pichula has died, honey. She's gone to be with Jesus. When Jesus comes back, he'll bring her with him, and then we'll all be together again. My daughter made me tell her that story at least 12 times that day. "Mommy, tell me again. Mommy, tell me again. Pichula has died, honey. She's gone to be with Jesus. When Jesus comes back, he'll bring Pichula with him and we'll all be together again." So finally, it's bedtime, yeah? And all of you who've got little people in your world, you know that this is the great marathon of the day, right? So the lights are out, the noisemaker's on. I'm lying next to my sweet child, and my girl is still brokenhearted. And she asks me one more time. And there I am in the dark, and I tell her one more time, "Honey, Pichula has died. She's gone to be with Jesus. When Jesus comes back, he'll bring her with him, and we'll all be together again." And here it comes. "My sweet child, but Mama, what if Jesus loses Pichula? Or what if he forgets?" And my heart broke for her as I heard in her innocent questions the deepest questions of the human heart. What if he forgets? What if he's not good for his word? What if he loses me? And so I reassured my child with the same words I'm speaking to you today. Jesus never forgets, and he never loses anyone. So on our high holidays, as they approach, remember that Jesus chose to walk across this stage on the eve of the Exodus. He chose the Passover feast as the moment he would reinterpret that Exodus. He named you and I, the lost sons of Adam and the rebellious daughters of Eve, the ones in need of rescue. And he named himself the sacrificial victim whose blood would rescue us from the death angel and by which the oaths of the Almighty would be sworn to secure a new covenant. Guys, remember that once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. We are not done yet. His fourth cup is still sitting in the middle of the table. And this one who has sworn to us with his life, he never forgets and he never loses anyone. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen.